listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2014 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud.
I have never stopped loving anyone that I ever loved, and I have loved everyone who was considerate of me and my troubles, Tennessee Williams wrote to a friend. I decided to read John Lahr's biography this last weekend in style, so it was a steamy hot Sunday afternoon. I put on a kimono jacket, put a shot of bourbon on the side table, and that was really heaven, I have to say. John Lahr's biography of Tennessee Williams' Mad Pilgrimage of the Flesh is a portrait of a soul in extremis, and it's a book that you can't put down. As the Telegraph of London noted, John Lahr's biography was a long time coming and will take a lot longer to surpass. Tonight we'll hear from author John Lahr about the process of writing his magisterial work about Tennessee Williams, the brilliant artist whose troubled life, his loves, his creative drives, his collaborations, his neuroses, Lahr's chronicles always in the context of the playwright's work. And I agree with playwright John Guare, who wrote of Lahr's book, Tennessee Williams had two great pieces of luck, Ilya Kazan to direct his work, and now John Lahr to make thrilling sense of his life. Lahr, the longtime drama critic for The New Yorker, is a witty and elegant stylist as well as a scrupulous researcher. By bringing to the project his own formidable understanding of theater, he brings us into the depths of Tennessee Williams' psyche. Lahr is himself a Tony winner for his collaboration on the one-woman show Elaine Stritch at Liberty. He co-produced the 1987 film Prick Up Your Ears, based on his Joe Orton biography of the same title. He's published 17 books on theater and two novels and numerous movie scripts and has written fabulous profiles for The New Yorker. His book, Dame Edna Everage and the Rise of Western Civilization, won award for the best book on the performing arts in 1992, and he's also the author of a biography of his father, comedian Bert Lahr, a book titled Notes on a Cowardly Lion, and I'll just stop there. We're very honored to have in conversation with John Lahr tonight the award-winning novelist Armistead Maupin, author of the beloved Tales of the City series, which sparked three television miniseries and a musical that premiered at San Francisco's American Conservatory Theater. Armistead was last at Aloud, as many of you here probably were here as well, for his final book in the series, The Days of Anna Madrigal. And he flew in to do this tonight. We're so thrilled. Please welcome both John Lahr and Armistead Maupin. Thank you.
I have to say I would fly anywhere with any excuse to be with John Lahr, because not only do I love him and his writing, but I love the people that he loves. We've been backstage talking about Dame Edna for the last 15 minutes. I think it would be interesting to talk about how you got this job, as it were.
Williams died in 1983, by which time I'd written the book on biography of Joe Orton, an English playwright who was murdered by his lover, and which was a sort of cult book in England. And I was called by Williams's estate and asked to write the authorized biography of Tennessee Williams. I was flattered. I went, I looked, I read the archive, and Williams's mother, Edwina, had logorrhea, and Williams had sort of grapharia. He could not stop writing. He wrote 8 hours a day. He wrote poems. He wrote wonderful letters. He wrote, of course, plays and many drafts of those plays that could easily fill the half of this auditorium. It was just too much. I had a seven-year-old child, an English wife, who didn't like America particularly. There was no way that I was going to get over there to do that. So I passed. I didn't know at the time that Williams himself had authorized someone with two letters, a man who was a theater producer. Typically, Williams had authorized this man to write his biography, and the man had never, ever written a book.
This is Lyle Leveridge.
Lyle Leveridge, thank you. And so I just let it go. Cut to 1994. I'm the senior drama critic in The New Yorker, and Lyle comes to me. He's written the book, but he can't get it published. He can't get it published because the soi-disant executor of Williams' literary estate, called Maria Lady St. Just, or Lady Maria St. Just, neither a lady nor a saint nor just, who was really responsible for the upkeep of his lobotomized sister Rose, who it cost $300,000 a year to keep her in the manner to which she became accustomed. So therefore had to generate a lot of income. So she got involved in the play aspect of his work, but she was never, as she claimed, the literary executor. What had happened was she had appointed James Laughlin, the head of New Directions, the publishing house that published Williams, to vet the manuscript. She had once upon a time been engaged to be married to Laughlin, and Laughlin read the manuscript and declared it not proper for publication. And Lyle could not get this book out of this sort of jail, this purdah that he was caught in. And he came to me because he had some information about, he couldn't sue her, he didn't have the money, but he said, maybe if you could write an article. And that became the first profile I ever wrote at The New Yorker. I've written over 40 now, so it was a long time ago. Now, what came to pass was that by the time she died, I was so outraged by the sort of moral torture that this diktat had imposed on this man that I went out and I researched it for 3 or 4 months, and here's what I had at the end of it. Had she been alive, I think I could have put her in jail. I had her on attempted murder. She tried to push Williams's brother Dakin off a catwalk. On fiduciary irresponsibility, she had gone into the archive, one of the three archives, the holdings of Williams' papers, the original one in Austin, and insisted that she be allowed to be alone with the material, which you can't do. It's a gigantic and brilliant archive. And she was alone with the material, and she took a razor, and she cut out the offending sentences in certain letters of his. But she didn't. She wasn't an educated woman. She didn't understand that at universities they have microfiche. So you could hold the letters up, and they look like Swiss cheese, right? Worst thing, and in a sense, the reason why this Lyle's book and subsequently my book are important is that because she believed that no academic and no critic should quote from Williams's work without paying, she barred even the Xeroxing of archival material, which always has a stamp on it saying this can't be used except without copyright permission. She barred the use of all that, so that essentially between when he died and until Lyle's book was published, there was no discussion about Williams in America. He flatlined, which was terrible, terrible for him.
And she suppressed some of the plays.
Yes, she did, two or three. And she suppressed another book that dealt with his late plays. So what happened was that I got Mr. Laughlin on the phone. It was really one of the best days of my life, which was all joyous at The New Yorker, but really outstanding day. We were all on a speakerphone. Lyle was there and a cohort of his who ran the Gotham Bookmark called Andreas Brown. And I said to Mr. Laughlin, well, why did you stop the book? And he said, in a word, blackmail. It turns out that to this day, then and to this day, Williams is the highest, single highest earner on the New Directions list. And she was threatening, unless he did her bidding, to withdraw all those copyrights. He also was going to be publishing a book of his letters to Williams. And, of course, she controlled those copyrights, too. There was going to be no book unless those copyrights were forthcoming. And so, because the estate could see that this was going to be a very embarrassing story that the New Yorker was going to publish, the lawyers who had sort of let Maria run riot because she was imperious and she was quite difficult and headstrong and reckless, they just let her alone. And it looked bad on them. And so what they did was they finally just said, oh, okay, let the book be published. The book was published. It was, I have to say, it's amazing. Lyle did a great job. I reviewed it. My quote is on the cover of his book. He did a wonderful job, and he marshaled an enormous amount of new information about Williams, about his early life. It was called Tom, and it dealt with his life before Glass Menagerie, because once the curtain came down on the Glass Menagerie, there were 24 curtain calls, he was no longer Tom Williams. He was Tennessee Williams, and on a first-name basis with the world forever. He was in the spotlight all his life. And so we became friends. And in passing, he said, look, if anything were to happen to me, would you finish? Because I didn't particularly agree with his view of his family or indeed his approach to biography, which was encyclopedic. You know, and then he went, and then he did, and then this happened, and that happened. And he really didn't have, he was not a theater historian, and he really wasn't sort of interested in what the plays meant, but he did just do a great service to Williams. And then I was in San Francisco covering an opening of a Tom Stoppard play, and Carrie Perloff said, did you hear Lyle died? And he had left me in his will to finish the job. And I decided to do it, but the reason my book is not a second volume of his is that I wanted to do something completely different. I wanted to essentially talk about and write about the life, the public life, the private life, and interpret the plays as they were intended by Williams, who said that that his plays represented his interior life at the time of the writing. And I wanted to track his interior geography from the moment when he said originally in 1938, I want to create I want to paint a picture of my heart. And as that heart opened, flowered, and ossified, so the plays dealt with that change. And that's sort of what I wanted to do. So my book was completely different, but I owe the opportunity to do it, the good luck to Lyle, who sort of passed the baton to me.
Yeah, I don't want to go back to her, the lady who was neither a lady nor a saint nor just, for much more. I want to get a grasp on that. Was she sort of basically a fag hag who mistook herself for a widow?
Well, that's a pecan phrase.
It's a Tennessee Williams title. Isn't
no,
it?
I mean she certainly was. She was the faggiest, haggiest.
She didn't like to think of him as gay, really, did she? She's tried to stop certain plays because
Williams. She was a piece of work. She was Williams used her as the model for Maggie the Cat because she was not only because she was vital, but she was a fabulist. She was great, as he said in his memoir. She had a problem with grandiosity. She was capable of amazingly capricious, reckless acts. Before she hitched her wagon to Williams' star, she was a very minor actress. She hitched her wagon to John Gielgud's star, and she was on stage in a play with Gielgud in a very minor role. And Gielgud was complaining to her that Dame Edith Evans was coughing during his lines. And so one night, she actually picked up a pillow and muffled Edith Evans on stage. She did this, and for which she was banned forever from the tenant organization. So essentially, she couldn't get work. And around that time, she met Williams. And Williams was, first of all, you know, in England, couldn't make change. He couldn't move around. And Maria sort of took him in hand, was a great deal of fun, and enlivened him. And she had a very, very waspish mouth. She was funny to a fault. And would say anything to people, and did all her life. And Williams had to actually caution her to tone it down, but he is actually amused by it, and she created scenes which he could observe and use, and they got into his plays, you know. It was, and so that's who she was. So to the question of, she actually was perhaps a fag hag, but in Maria's case, she actually, as she told Arthur Miller, she had fantasies of marrying Tennessee.
Yeah, that's what I meant.
Turning him sort of hetero, yeah, to a degree. And this was news to Tennessee.
Well, there's a and to Pancho and.
Well, Pancho was one of the, I didn't, when I took over Lyle's book, I inherited 7 FedEx boxes of his material, which for my purposes was largely useless because I was interested in interpreting the plays with a life. But what I did get from him was one really valuable thing, which is in my book, which was he did do an interview with Pancho, who was the basis for Stanley Kowalski. Mm. Pancho was an unlettered former, he was discharged from the military for bad behavior. He was an alcoholic, wild man, and Tennessee was thrilled by him because he was the first person at the age of, I think, 33 that he'd ever lived with. Tennessee had never had sex until he was 26, according to him.
Never masturbated until he was 26.
Yeah, indeed. That's kind of a record. but he came from, he was Alma Weinmiller in Summer and Scope. He was an ascetic hysteric who transformed himself, willed himself to deliberately, as it were, a sort of deliberate regression, thus mad pilgrimage of the flesh, into a carnal being over time. And that transformation is what essentially is, his plays sort of chart. The early plays, say, Battle of Angels, Sevier, which is a family name in Williams's family tree, also is Savior. And the character comes into town and with a silver bullet of sexuality transforms everybody. Mm. This is Williams. And then there's Stanley, and then there's Alvaro Mangiacavallo. These are sort of the primitive romantic sexual ideals that he incorporated into his fantasy world, but were representative of this emotional transformation that he underwent, and with great robustness, as it turns out.
That portion of the book really rang a bell for me because I'm a Southerner that came from a family. I think a lot of us think we may have come from that family in some ways. He made the point that he actually felt at one point, like Elia Kazan, the director with whom he collaborated for so long, that promiscuity actually was a force for creativity.
I think that was that was certainly a deep connection between them because as has been pointed out to me, that sexuality is the beginning of knowledge and curiosity. And when you read Williams's early plays, they're technically sort of terrific, but they're not open. They're not full of life and all the textures that involvement with other people and have. They're sort of arid, and once he starts to be a sexual being, it becomes another kind of play, a completely other kind of play. But the promiscuity, and this is a sort of interesting thing about Williams. In chronicling you're right that it did open him up to creativity, but by the end, he had another view of it, or at least he allowed another view of it in a play called Small Craft Warnings, in a late play whose title indicates a certain decline in his abilities, Small Craft Warnings. He writes about how the consistent promiscuity leads to a loss of wonder and even a certain kind of hardness, which I think, I mean, I think that position in as he, which was written again in the late in the 70s, made him not a poster boy for gay liberation, although he was a pathfinder in his way prior to that. He was the first person to actually put gay issues on the stage in Camino Real, and of course, more famously, I suppose, in Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, where Brick really, his love for his former football player was part of the drama of the play, and the erotic ghost that seizes and Brick's imagination and really prevents him from joining the world, in a sense, forces him to drink and decline, to refuse life and refuse family and refuse any connection to Maggie.
And you make the point in the book, really, that he never completely shakes his Calvinism lives with him his entire life.
Yes, because I think to a certain extent there was always, you know, his mother, part of my thesis is that the mother's disgust at the flesh, she never had sex with her husband, who was called Cornelius C.C., after 1918, he was banished from the, and then Tennessee reports that when she did have sex, that she screamed in such a way that the kids had to run out of the house, and he was frightened by that. She compelled fear into both her with all children about sexuality, to the degree that Williams always felt a kind of a disgust at the flesh, at least initially, and associated flesh with sin, and he never altogether lost it. No, not altogether. It was
And his the parents were polar opposites in that the father was a drunken carouser and he was
He was, but I think he was, and I think Williams came to after analysis in the mid 50s. Williams changed his story about the father, and he saw that the father was hard done by. I mean, the Glass Menagerie. I mean, Williams called himself the definition of hysteria, and essentially, Williams is the story that Williams told. His mother was hysteric as well. Was the mother's story, the mother's story of the marriage, and that was in Williams, as you'll read, or if you read as you've read. He changed that story because he could see that the father had been, quite, you know, the father withheld money from the family. The mother withheld affection, and not only that, turned the children against the father. And you know, so that it was really a war between the parents, at which the children were sort of startled witnesses, seeing these indigestible, crazy scenes: a mother fainting, a father chasing her through the house, punching down a door. There were huge secrets in the family. The father never explained about his childhood, the fact that his mother had died, never explained the violence. The mother, Edwina, in her own book, Remember Me to Tom, never admitted. She said, all of us are actors in order to survive. She never told the children about her life. She just filled them with her grievance. So it was just a violent family in which the mantra was, you can't have the feelings that you have. And that is where, when Williams turned to the stage, he had only seen two plays. But he says, really interestingly, I had a whole stage inside me. And the way that he could express this, get it out, was to re-present it on stage. And, you know, it's in the plays, since he wasn't seen in his family, he could be seen and he could admit himself on stage, you know, and that, which he does, all his plays. The Glass Menagerie begins with, I am a narrator and a character in this play. That never changed. He is a narrator and a character in all the plays. And I just want to say, this is a good place to say, when I was in the middle of this search for Williams, I read a book, a brilliant book, called Hysteria, by a psychoanalyst who's in the audience called Christopher Ballas. And I couldn't quite understand it. It was too erudite for me. But I did know that there was truth in it. And over time, because Kit lived in England, always American, we talked, and I acknowledge him in the book. But when I read it, I suddenly thought, wow, I'm going to call Dakin Williams. And I called up Dakin Williams, Williams's younger brother. And I said, Dakin, did your mother ever kiss you, hug you? He said, no. I said, didn't you ask to be kissed? He said, why would you ask for something you were never going to get? What Williams' mother's he said talk was her erotic connection. So this sort of very much corresponded to what Ballas had written. Her connection was talk. She verbed her children, but she didn't touch them. And if you go back and look at Glass Menagerie, the stage directions only call for Amanda to touch her children twice in the whole play. Although actors may add that to it. In depicting the story unconsciously, he caught that in his family, constellation.
Yet she was there, sitting with him on opening nights. She was around for a long time, taking a sort of pleasure in the fame.
Well,
right?
Yeah, a pleasure and half the royalties. And he gave her half the royalties. And this is interesting because, in a sense, Williams had a sort of Oedipal victory. He killed the father. The money that the mother got from the play allowed her to leave her hated husband. And so it's kind of weird what he succeeded in doing.
Yeah, I think Gore Vidal said that this was his repertory. The family was Williams's repertory company.
Well, you know, that's a kind of, you know, I think Gore is very both a very reliable witness and a very unreliable one. But when in that observation is a kind of brilliant observation, I think, because William had. And this is Williams had his internal objects, this family, this indigestible, crazy family. By the way, when Rose was sent into sectioned and went to the sanitarium, I have and reproduce in the book the psychiatric report of her first. Encounter with the analyst, with the therapist. And she says, right there at the very beginning, my family is mad. And they were. Mm. They were driving them, and they did drive them crazy to a degree. And Williams was
committed.
Not only committed, but certainly a borderline person.
And you kind of feel that probably Dakin had a good reason to.
Oh, absolutely. Dakin saved Williams' life in 1969. He would have been dead.
But he never got credit.
No, he saved his life, and for that, Williams cut him out of his will. Williams died worth $5 or $6 million, and Dakin got $25,000.
Wow.
He sued. He ended up getting $100,000, but you know, he humiliated him. But he didn't. Williams humiliated him in the will, but of course. It was a losing game because Dakin had the last laugh. Williams wanted to be buried at sea, and and Williams buried him next to his mother.
And charged admission, right?
Well, he wanted to turn it, but I mean, talk about revenge.
Yes, he had this whole plan about young revolutionaries were going to take him out on a shrimp boat.
He wanted to be buried. His great literary idol was Hart Crane. And I've seen the will. He wanted to be buried at sea as close as possible to where Hart Crane had sort of disappeared. And they wouldn't do that. Instead, they buried him in St. Louis. And as you said, Dakin had ideas of turning that into a sort of a tourist attraction.
Yeah.
And charging money.
Well, let's back up a little bit, because this is getting very Tennessee Williams. by which I mean gloomy. And I was thinking this afternoon, what is the moment in the book, in your book, that seems most triumphant? And for me, it's after the success, I guess it's the opening night, of Streetcar Named Desire, and Brando has put Williams...
I don't mean to correct you.
No, please.
Williams was so confident after Streetcar Named Desire that his next play was... I think they did a revival on Broadway of Summer and Smoke, which was a great failure.
Is that when they do the motorcycle ride?
Yeah, and they were. It was at a. He threw a bad review party. If he'd have waited about two decades, he'd have had a hell of a party. But at that party, Brando and he, with Williams riding Pillion, rode around Manhattan on the motorcycle. And so the greatest actor of his time. And the greatest playwright of his time,
with his knees clamped around the greatest ass of his time.
Yes, that. Yeah, that's right. And but feeling that, you know, the point is that they on that motorcycle, feeling the momentum of their new of their arrival and their power.
Yeah.
And to me, I agree with you.
It's a wonderful poetic moment. It's the moment in the movie. It's beautiful.
Yeah, great.
Tell us some Lorette. I had no idea that Lorette Taylor was not entirely in her right mind when she had that giant triumph.
You know, it's true of any book, in any biography.
Drunk is what I was trying to say.
I know, but I was going to lead into that by saying you have to have a little luck in a biography. Very early on, I found at Columbia an oral history that, for some reason, I guess because nobody was really interested in the plays, but just interested in his famous life and his sensational life, an oral history of Eddie Dowling, who will not mean very much to you, except to maybe Miles down there, who knows these things. But Eddie Dowling acted, co-produced, and co-directed the first production of Glass Menagerie. And so it was a first person, I mean, it was a primary source that nobody had tapped into. Great piece of luck. Lorette Taylor had been banned from Broadway theater for 5 years for being intoxicated on stage, and her comeback was Glass Menagerie, and they had watched her like a hawk in Chicago, and on the opening night of the play in New York, he had kept the actors rehearsing until 5:30, and he went home to change and have a bite to eat, and he called them back at 7 for another run through, and when he came back to the theater, it had been a very hot day, and the Times said it was one of the hottest days on record, and there'd suddenly been a big storm, and there was Lorette Taylor outside in the alley, drunk as a skunk on opening night. They had to walk her around for an hour. She went on, and she went immediately into the second act of the play. Dowling describes bringing her back in, and she then proceeded to give what most people say, and certainly was thought up to then, one of the great performances, a kind of miraculous channeling of the character, that one of the greatest performances 20th century theater. I had a friend of mine who I lived with in England for like 20 years, the wife of Carol Rice, was an actress called Betsy Blair, who was understudying Julie Hayden in that part. And she was in the wings, and Taylor would come, and this is, other people describe it, Taylor would walk off as Amanda. They had a pail out there. She would vomit into the pail and go back out. But it was like a transcendent performance. And after that performance, as I said, there were 24 curtain calls. But there were so many people that wanted to get backstage that they had to lift the curtain, the safety curtain up. So it was like the Yankees winning the pennant or something. Some major event had happened. And really, what Arthur Miller said, which is great. I know Miller, and I talked to him a lot in the course of the biography. It was the Williams had planted the flag of beauty on commercial theater, is what he said. He showed a way for playwrights to write about their inner life as well as the external reality. And so that actually, if you, what he made it possible for Miller to write Death of a Salesman, whose original title was Inside His Head. He also made it possible for a playwright like Tony Kushner, who sort of, as I've said elsewhere, he's sort of the bastard child of Tennessee and Arthur Miller, you know. I mean, he gets to do both things, the internal and lyrical and the social comment. So it was a great and revolutionary moment for American theater. And it launched the plays and Williams' exploration of himself just at a time when, I mean, Williams always said that his plays couldn't be heard during wartime because they were about people, about emotions that were too fragile and too frail. And the play, Williams said that the Glass Menagerie was providential. Not only did it open on Easter Sunday, I mean, it came on 2 weeks before the end of the war, and once that war was over, America found itself all powerful, and the people who had suffered a depression of 10 years, a war, were suddenly found themselves in an economy, which was. Over the next 10 years, the individual per capita income of Americans tripled. It was the greatest rise of wealth in the history of Western civilization. And Williams's theme, which was desire, appetite, the expansion of the destiny of me, the pursuit of individualism, and an interest in the interior life, this was now what all America was interested in. So his theme, his own themes and the mutation of American consciousness at that time sort of coalesced, and it was sort of providential. And he wrote that until the next war,
yeah,
in the middle of the 60s, when he fell out of favor.
Yeah, and had the greatest string of successes on Broadway during that time, and he never stopped working.
No, never stopped working. And that was, we were talking about at the whole issue of output, which is so different in America than in England.
Yeah, yeah. I was mentioning earlier to John that part of me, when you read about all this self torture that's going on with Williams about what the reviews are and who respects him and who doesn't, and you think, isn't there a moment where you can actually sit down and say, I'm Tennessee Williams, I'm the greatest playwright of the 20th century, and I'm going to Key West with Frank, and I'm going to stay there for a while. In fact, critics actually said that to him, didn't they?
They said to stop.
They said stop.
But the reality is, Williams was not. I mean, Williams certainly was writing. Was what I love about Williams is he bet his life. He bet everything on his imagination. He was going for it, and he knew he was either going to make it or he was going to crash.
Yeah.
He knew that at the beginning. It was very romantic, you might say, but he had nothing else, and this was it. and he bet on himself, and he won, and then for a lot of reasons that we could discuss, that bet was hedged and lost, and not really lost, but it just became much more problematic. I lost my way here, so bring me back.
Well, I'm having too good a time. Tell me about, I want to hear about the time, because I haven't heard it. You met him once.
Only once. I was briefly the literary manager of Lincoln Center. And the first show we did, I was involved in, was Camino Real. And we gave it its first major revival. And he was there, but it was shocking to see him, because he literally had to be lifted into his chair. He was paralytic. And I did meet him afterwards, but, you know, he certainly wouldn't have remembered me. I don't think he could remember anything. He was just in his
Was room. He with Dr. Feelgood at that point?
Yes, he would have been.
Yeah.
He would have been.
He was getting something called fire shots.
Yes, I think you know a little bit more about this than
no,
I do.
No, I've just read your book.
He was not alone. President Kennedy was online for fire shots.
Oh,
too.
Yeah, he was.
There were a lot of people on fire shots, and they certainly liberated Williams. Williams wrote one really good play, and one that should be considered in among his great plays, which had a bad first night, which I was at. It was directed by Alan Schneider, and the play was called Gnadiges Fräulein. And it was a wonderful play, very bitter and funny and surreal, and whose attempts to sort of locate the audience, the new audience, which he thought he'd lost or couldn't find because the taste of in the mid-60s was changing. And he wrote this Ionesco-like play. He did it very well. But that's all really, on amphetamines. It's all very high energy.
Yeah.
Fun.
Well, I was by 1976, he was in San Francisco doing This Is an Entertainment with AC. Well, I think it was ACT.
Right. Did you see that?
Now, this is the way I'm telling my only Williams story. It's pathetic, but I've got one. And since only the two of us were there, I could have made up all sorts of things. But he was at a gallery opening south of Market, a very brightly lit gallery, and I'd hurried down there because I heard that Tennessee Williams was going to be at this little opening. I think it was some kind of like a leather show or something. And it was, as I say, fiercely bright. And I walked into the room, and he was there, this little man with this round face, this sort of rictus of a smile, surrounded by people who were all trying to get their heads. I thought of this when we were doing our selfie earlier, John. How he would not have survived at all if he'd had Facebook and could have get on there and read the comments. You know, killed him off. But I thought it was the grimmest image of fame I'd ever seen in my life. I remember being really quite horrified by it, all these people trying to be with him and how he didn't seem connected to them. And I left the gallery, and I went out and sat on a car out in the parking lot and lit up a joint. And 5 minutes later, he came out. And he came over, and he saw what I was doing. I hadn't met him. And he looked at me and said, "Would you mind terribly?" So I gave him the joint. We both sat on the car. I realized that this was not the time to say, "Oh, Mr. Williams, I love your work." So we just smoked a joint together.
That's a lovely story.
Thank you. I knew he was having as bad a time at that party as I was.
Good story.
I think we're coming close to our time here. Let me see if there's anything I want to ask. Well, I guess the point I want to make, what I loved about the book is precisely the fact that it's not a biographical sequence. It follows the work itself. And when you say it's autobiographical, it doesn't necessarily mean there's something that happens in this play that happens in his life, but it's emotionally autobiographical.
That's right. That's what he meant too.
Sweet Bird of Youth is about the punishment of fame, which he was beginning to feel.
Yes, and it's also, for instance, at the end of Sweet Bird of Youth, Chance is offered a chance to go to Hollywood, go back to Hollywood, or to stay and face his death. And he chooses death. He says at the end of the play, wonderful line, you know, life's got to mean something. And what Williams's plays do chart absolutely clearly throughout is that Williams is, at a certain point in time, having been blocked in his work, Williams started to drink and take drugs and to become both a voyeur and an exhibitionist of his own collapse, a kind of connoisseur of his own collapse. And he destroyed himself over time for meaning, to the point that, you know, he was devouring himself. And he even wrote about that. He called Suddenly Last Summer,
yeah,
Where a Man is Devoured, he called it an allegory. And it was. It was an allegory of his own self-destruction. And, you know, I've mentioned this earlier today at another event here at the library, but Oscar Wilde said a wonderfully provocative thing. He said, the artistic life is a long, lovely suicide. And it seems to me that Williams's life, when you really look at it closely, it's something that Williams knew very early on was going to happen to him. I mean, when Blanche, for instance, with Stanley in the final draft, we don't really know what Stanley does. Blanche indicates that at some point that she wants somebody to murder her or something out of her self-loathing. Mm. But in the first draft, when Stanley was called Ralph had a job. He sold mortuary equipment. And so early on in Williams's imagination, this battle between creativity or self-destruction and creativity, like some sort of stain on the canvas, was already there. And over time, and frustration and achievement and fame and betrayal, that stain got bigger and bigger and bigger until, to a certain extent, the creativity, that connection to the green world of his imagination, his unconscious, was severed, I think, and he could never quite get back to it. And in his Faustian bargain with himself, I think there was a lot of self-loathing in that, you know. I think that his life as a whole played out as a sort of slow suicide.
Rounded out by Elysian Fields to the Hotel Elysee.
There you go. Cemeteries. Yeah.
Yeah. It was sort of a shock to me in the book. I'd always bought the bottle cap. He choked on a bottle cap. Story.
No, not true. Yeah. At all. It was a sort of canard. There was a sort of strange thing that happened with the coroner. They actually, for some reason, I don't know why they did this. They were worried there would be some mischief about. He said that it was subsequently showed that it was not possible for the bottle cap to have choked him. But he also they sent another body. The Williams's body was actually the body of somebody who had jumped from a building or something, in order to protect Williams, the information from leaking to the press. It was a big fiasco over the death. In fact, as the autopsy proved, and I publish in the book, his body was just loaded with Seconal. Every organ was just saturated in Seconal. He killed himself.
Questions?
Thank you. Do you have any comments about Andre Previn's opera, Streetcar?
I didn't. his opera of
Streetcar, Named Desire.
No, I don't have any comments on it. I didn't see it, so I'm sorry. A lot of Williams's plays, because they are operatic, do lend themselves. I think actually Summer and Smoke is much better as an opera than it is as a play, because it's schematic but full of feeling. I can't imagine Streetcar as an opera being comparable to the nuances of the play.
Thank you very much.
Okay. I wonder if you could talk about... I wonder if you could talk about how you decided which plays to lay end to end to make a dramatic story for the...
I followed his life. I mean, I did it sequentially, because the whole trope of the book is that, as he said, the plays reflect where my internal world at the time of writing. So I followed the major plays right through to the very last major plays, which was A House Not Meant to Stand, which is a very interesting play, because he really said, Armistead mentioned Vidal's statement about his repertory of actors. And in that play, Williams, in the guise of a dying woman, says goodbye to all these internal objects. Says goodbye to them. They take leave of him as he was in fact taking leave of life. It's really quite an amazing play. And it had a production in Chicago. It was given a production by Gregory Mosher, who then became head of Lincoln Center. And he offered to bring that play, Williams' Last, to Lincoln Center, and Lady St. Just stopped it. Although she'd never seen the play, she thought it wasn't right. So it never was, it's not yet been done. I hope it will someday soon have a performance.
Why was his sister lobotomized?
That's a very good question, Judy. She wasn't immediately lobotomized. She was. She went in 1938, and they tried various sulfur treatments. But the real reason was because in her anger at her mother, her provocation at her mother's absolutely. Williams called her a monolithic Puritan. She told her that she'd abused herself with church candles. And her mother could not stand the thought of that and wanted it wiped out, according to Williams. And indeed, in her book, what Edwina says is she now remembers, this is almost a quote, she now remembers only the nice things. But this, what's startling is not that just that she was lobotomized, but that after the lobotomy, she had over 66 electric shock treatments. So this went on forever.
She was delusional, right? I mean, she was a virgin.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right here. Hi, Mr. Lahr. I'm wondering if you could speak to Mr. Williams' relationship with Ilya, his conflicted relationship with Ilya Kazan.
Yeah, that's a good question, and thank you for asking it. That's one of the big discoveries for me, and surprises of the research. They were a great team. They are certainly the greatest theatrical collaboration of the 20th century. I guess the second one might be Lloyd Richards and August Wilson, but they were a great team. I like to explain that. Williams had no father, really. His father referred to him as Miss Nancy. He had no interest in his son, showed him very little affection. His son was afraid of him. He never had what a father might give to a child. Was never boundaried. He didn't really take him in hand. He didn't all the things that lead to sort of problem solving and penetration he didn't have. When Kazan was a forceful man, I met him at the end of his life. He gave me a carte blanche to use his papers. And to meet him, even when he was not in full command of his capacities, was astonishing. He was powerful. And he was, as Marlon Brando said, he was the greatest director he'd ever worked with. He, for Williams, he was a kind of father figure. He was strong. He was forceful. He could talk to Williams, partially because of this thing you mentioned about Williams trusted his emotional. They had similar backgrounds. Kazan's father also disdained him, didn't want him. When Kazan said he wanted to be an actor, the father said to him, "Have you looked in the mirror?" So that they shared that same rebellious quality. They share the same commitment to art. They share the same promiscuity, and the belief in that. And what Kazan gave him, you know, his nickname was Gadget. He fiddled, and Kazan had a great gift for structure. And Williams didn't. Williams had a great gift for poetry and his imagination. He couldn't always see the possibilities in what he did. For instance, Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, he wanted to be one act with another play. He didn't see that he'd created this great character, Big Daddy, that actually had to be, we had to see more of him in the third act. He didn't get that. All of that was coaxed out of him by Williams, by Kazan, who would say to him, "This play is not ready to be shown. Go back, do it again, try this." So that when you look at the broad output of Williams in the 50s. Kazan didn't direct Rose Tattoo, but Williams wrote Rose Tattoo finally to Kazan's outline. Cat on a Hot Tin Roof was entirely developed, not entirely, but really profoundly affected structurally, both Brick and Big Daddy were substantially rewritten to Kazan's encouragement in design, in a way.
And you have the proof of this in the letters to each.
Oh, yeah.
The things he wrote, there's amazing, eloquent letters talking Williams into doing it.
You know, it's part of the fun of this, and it's a trick that you learn if you write New Yorker profiles. I believe that if you get the metabolism of the voice, the rhythm, I do a lot with letters and quotations. And there's a reason for that. The reason is that each person has their own idiom and their own rhythm and their own heartbeat. And that heartbeat is underneath the words. It's not the words themselves. It's actually underneath it. And once you get, when people are actually arguing about art and how to make something, if you bring the quotes, if you get Kazan here and Williams here, and they're actually talking, you get the people, the drama of these minds trying to make something. And that's what I was going for. And there's a great deal
really
of...
It's the best thing. It's one of my favorite things about
There's a great deal of electricity between them. And the point is, why I wanted to stay with the work is, the work was all Williams cared about. He really wasn't very interested in people. You know, for love I make characters. He didn't love the world. He didn't. He said famously, "I'm at the end of a day's work, I'm indifferent to people. I try to say that it's my work, but basically, I don't care." That was published in 1980. That phrase in an essay called "Man in an Overstuffed Chair," but actually it was written in 1962. So that feeling prevailed very early in Williams's life. Now Kazan, also in Sweetbird, which was the last play Kazan directed on Broadway, Williams wrote two really great acts and a second act, which is political, which really doesn't work, but Kazan was able to finesse it. And make it a successful play. So all those are great successful plays of Kazan's and Williams. But when they broke up, and I'm coming back now to Cat, something really interesting happened. when Cat was a success, Sweet Bird of Youth is about a woman who is running away from a sure failure that turns out to be a hit. That was Cat on a Hot Tin Roof. Because Williams thought, on the first night of Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, that the play had failed because of the terribly, but the Broadway ending, Kazan ending, he called it, the Broadway ending. He told Edward R. Murrow this was prostitution. And he insisted subsequently on publishing in the same volume as he published the Broadway ending, his ending, which was ambivalent and not at all positive. There's no hope at the end of his ending that Brick and Maggie are going to get together. Now, when they broke up, in an absolutely sensational series of letters that we print, but it was just, because Kazan, as you know, his letters have recently been published, and I recommend you read them. They're just fabulous. Kazan said, you know, I will not be criticized for ruining your plays and giving you another hit. you know, I've had it with that. And in that, he said, look, when we opened Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, I said to you, I'll do your ending. Let's do your ending on Broadway. And you said, no, well, let's go with yours. So what you're seeing there is Williams couldn't believe that he sold out his artistic integrity for commercial success. He couldn't believe it. And he created this legend of essentially Broadway corruption, Kazan having to sort of bend to the will of the director when it was his will that created that. And I think, moreover, that it was, he couldn't believe on some, because he was as vainglorious as the princess in Sweetbird, he couldn't believe that really this great oeuvre that he created owed a great deal more than he would like to admit to the penetration, the organization of Kazan. I think that Williams, of course, was a great writer, and the first Glass Menagerie and Streetcar had hardly any really major rewrites. But all increasingly, as he was blocked, he needed help. We all do. I mean, every writer you read in The New Yorker is edited, and well edited. So it's all like shampoo and blow dry, right? And he could, you know, he couldn't accept that. And the proof of the pudding is that after their breakup, with the exception of Night of the Iguana, Williams never found a director with whom he could collaborate. He couldn't trust him. He couldn't, and as a consequence, he often took bad notes. He often did things which weren't effective for the plays. But when with Kazan, it was sort of a really mind meld. And so your question is that it's just, it is a major contribution, which I don't think actually, although Kazan certainly has gotten more than enough credit, I think Williams would have always been a good playwright, but I don't think that his major plays would have penetrated the culture to the degree that they did, would have captured the audience and those characters been elevated to sort of almost folkloric dimension, I mean, beyond the plays. We just have to say Stanley, Amanda, Maggie, and they transcend the plots of the plays. That wouldn't have happened because the plays wouldn't have been right in the way that as entertainments. They wouldn't have been sort of strategically honed without Kazan's very brilliant work on them.
Could you say something about his view of the films, of his works, and whether he thought that was a sellout, given some of the things you said?
I don't think they were a sellout. I mean, a lot of the films were bowdlerized, obviously, by Hallowried. I mean, the whole meaning of streetcar is completely reversed in the Hollywood ending. I mean, it's not the whole. We just saw it in New York in a movie theater, and at the end, the censors wanted Stanley to be punished. In fact, one of the suggestions was that he be called up in front of a jury and sentenced at one point. How about that for a brilliant idea? But the point of the play is not that Stanley is punished, but that Blanche is sacrificed so that Stanley and Stella's life can continue, the desire continue, the good. And so that was, he hated Suddenly Last Summer, which Gore Vidal wrote, thought it was terrible. He was pragmatic. He didn't like them. I mean, he didn't care about one fig about the film Baby Doll. Kazan sort of put it together from scraps that he would send in from Key West occasionally. He certainly liked the money, and I don't think he took it too seriously. He was a playwright, and he understood the value of stars, and he was happy to do it. But he was quickly soured of Hollywood. I mean, he thought. And if you go to the archive and see what the screenplay for Glass Menagerie, he writes on the script, "This is an abomination." You know, I mean, so he took the money and ran.
Well, I don't think it'll come as a surprise to anybody here that this book has been nominated for a National Book Award and is highly favored to win, from what I've heard.
From your mouth to God's ear.
Okay, all right. I have no doubt. Thank you, John. It's been a pleasure. And
thank
an
you for coming out here.
I always love talking to you, and doing it in front of a bunch of nice people is even better. So.
Good on you, babe. Thank you. Thank you.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.